Hi, this is IA Voice with a speech recording at the EuroIA conference in Berlin in 2006. Please enjoy it and send us your feedback to improve this program for you in upcoming episodes.
Ich bin ein Amsterdamer, is what I wanted to illustrate with this first slide. But despite that, I'm not a Dutchman, which explains my good English. It's my mother tongue, and so any mistakes I make are all my mother's fault. But I am a researcher at the Dutch National Search Center called CWI, which has the honour of being the first ever internet site in Europe, and in fact set up the European internet infrastructure. They spun off Euronet and NLNet, which were going to set up the Dutch and European infrastructures. And it's actually famous for quite a lot of things, that, though you probably don't know it. For instance, the word to dereference comes from the CWI, funnily enough. And Python will be another of the CWI's products that you know about. I've been there for quite a time now, and I originally went there to design a programming language, which was called ABC, which was actually an interesting programming language because it was the only language, certainly at that time, that had been designed as a user interface artifact. That is to say, let's pretend that a programming language is the interface between humans and computers. So how do we do that? Well, of course, you do requirements analysis. You do iterative design. You do user testing. And the funny thing is that a completely different sort of programming language came out of that. And that was a really interesting experiment. Kino von Rossum, who produced Python, then went on to produce Python, which has had more success than ABC. But that's partly because it's deliberately a system programming language, and ABC was deliberately not a system. Anyway, coming out of that work, we went into looking at generalized user interfaces, application architectures is what we called them. What we built was what you would now call a browser. If you saw it running now, you'd say that's a browser, although in those days that word didn't exist. And in fact, it had everything that a browser now has, such as extensible markup, style sheets, vector graphics, a DOM, client-side scripting. This was the end of the 80s, mind you. The only thing that it didn't do was it didn't use TCP/IP. So anyway, when the web came along, our group said, oh, we understand that. And so the group split into two, me and the rest. The rest went off and formed the first Dutch internet company and made themselves fantastically rich, and now they're extremely bored in their large homes, not knowing what to do with themselves, so I would teach them a lesson. I went off and organized two workshops at the first web conference and got as a result involved with World Wide Web Consortium, and as a result of that I'm co-author of a number of the specifications that you will be using in your daily life, including CSS, HTML4, XHTML, XMLens, XForms, and a number of others. And of course, I have a fantastic, exciting life, although I'm not as rich as I might have been. So I'm here today, really, not as an employee of the CWI, but actually because I'm the chair of the HTML and XForms working groups at W3C. And what I want to talk about is how that relates to information architecture, information design. But I should also point out that I've spent a lot of my professional life involved in HCI. That the fact that we designed a programming language along HCI principles and that the system, the browser that we built, was based for HCI reasons, for usability reasons, means that I've been involved in that area for a long time. I was chair of the CHI conference in 1997. I was on the executive committee of CHI for more than a decade. I was editor-in-chief of CHI Bulletin for 5 years and of Interactions for about 7 years. So what I want to say here is that I talk at quite a lot of conferences, but most of them are real hardcore geek conferences. So it's great to be at a conference like this, where I know that the audience is largely on my side, and that they understand the issue, so I sort of feel at home here, feel like I'm coming home. So this is just to show you the browser. This is actually a screenshot in 1993, but I demonstrated it, I think, in 1991 at an HCI conference. But what you can see here, that is an analog clock up in the corner, and then in the middle there, a digital clock. But actually, those are just two views of the same data structure. Those are just star sheets applied to a data structure. And that data structure is that one at the bottom there. It's just six numbers of the date and the time. And that is actually being driven by the number of seconds since 1970, which was a system value. And every time the system value changed, then that document got updated. And because of that, then the different views got updated. And the interesting thing was that to write that, the analog clock, for instance, was something like 12 to 20 lines of code, whereas in those days, to write an analog clock cost you at least 1,000 lines, and the largest I found was 4,000. But I'll be talking about more about that sort of thing later on. So the fact that the tools we use affect what we can do is maybe too obvious for words. But in fact, it's maybe also not as obvious as it could be. One of my favourite pieces of research which demonstrated this was a piece of research that investigated the quality of writing that people produced. The same person produced writing with different tools. So people were asked to write with a pen about something. People were asked to use a text editor to do it. And people were asked to use a sort of WYSIWYG system where you saw the result. And funnily enough, you don't produce the same quality and quantity of text for all of those. The tool that you use affects how you have the text that you actually produce, amazingly enough. With a pen, you produce less text, but it's actually of a high quality. With a text editor, apparently, from this research, you produce more text than with a pen, but the quality isn't as good. And finally, with a WYSIWYG editor, where you see the results as if it were a printed page, you write more text, and the quality is higher as well. Now, this is a surprising result, that the same person can produce different quality text based on the tool they use. Another interesting piece of research along these lines was research into the best user interface for playing chess games. And while it turns out that using a mouse to move pieces was the fastest way of playing, if you actually had an interface that allowed you to move pieces, that you won more games. And that was very interesting. Again, the same brain playing the same chess games, but the interface, the tools that you use to do that, affect your results. So, we could say that HTML is our main current tool for information delivery. And HTML has been an incredible success, there's no doubt about it. But on the other hand, you could say that HTML is sort of Garden of Eden, because not only has it produced such incredible success, but there are now immense numbers of guidelines from different communities on what you should or shouldn't do when producing HTML formatted documents. So there are documents for accessibility, what you should and shouldn't do in HTML if you want your pages to be accessible. Usability, there are internationalization, what you should do to make your pages visible over the whole world. There's metadata guidelines, there's device independence guidelines, mobile devices, as we've heard earlier. So actually, to produce your HTML, you have to have an enormous amount of information apart from just how to produce an HTML document. Because there are all these things that you should or shouldn't do when producing HTML. And so all these communities, because these guidelines come from different communities who are interested in the web, they've all come to the HTML working group with requests for changes for different approaches to their problems. And it's been the HTML working group's task to try and take all those various and diverse requirements and make something sensible, make some unified whole out of the result. And we've already got XHTML1, and what we did was split our task into two, because there was already a desire in the world for having SHTML, which was an XML version of HTML, for various reasons that I won't go into now. And we thought that was going to be a big enough task in itself, just getting that transition, to do that first and then do the other changes second. So in other words, XHTML1 is not really that different from HTML4. In fact, that was our aim, to make the smallest number of changes to turn it into an XHTML, an XML application. But so we've taken all these requirements, and XHTML2, which is what essentially I'm going to talk about today, is an attempt to bring all these various requirements together and create one cohesive whole. I'm not going to talk about it all. I haven't possibly got time in an hour to do that. So I'm going to pull out some essential threads. First, form, content, and essence. But also I want to talk about meaning, diversity, and function. So let's start with form. I would claim that the battle for splitting content and presentation has largely been won. HTML was originally designed only for representing document structure, only for representing the true information. And the plan had always been, when Tim Berners-Lee started the web, that the presentation would be done using style sheets. Unfortunately, the browser manufacturers got there first, and they didn't understand this essential essence of HTML, and they started adding all sorts of markup that was only about presentation. Link, of course, being the most obvious and horrible example. And I should say that that's pretty typical for browser manufacturers, that sort of quality that they can produce when they're designing markup. But having produced CSS, which W3C, when it formed, that was the first thing they went in and did, and they actually did extremely fast and got it out there, and the browser manufacturers largely have accepted that. I think partly due to the fact that Microsoft had made this blunder of saying that the internet would never be popular, and then when they realized actually it was going to be popular, and they got in and they wanted to show that they were as enthusiastic as possible, and so they embraced CSS very enthusiastically in the beginning. And that gave an impulse to the other browser manufacturers as well. So there are lots of reasons why separation of content and presentation are really important. And I imagine that most of you know them, and I mean, I can give you pages of advantages. But the separation of the terms of concerns, that the HTML is simpler to produce, and you can split the work on presentation off to experts just in that area. It means it's cheaper to produce and therefore easier to manage. It's very easy to change your house style because you don't have to change all your documents. And your documents are smaller. And the interesting figure is that ESPN, who switched from presentation-based HTML to content and presentation using CSS, say that they save 2 terabytes a day in bandwidth just by using CSS. So there's also a big money saving going on there. It means that your pages are more accessible, so you reach more people. Search engines find your stuff more easily. You're visible on more devices. And the argument that I use to show that CSS has come of age is CSS Zengarden, which is essentially a website with one web page, and this is it. This just shows you, a very simple version of the HTML here. It's a single HTML file that's just got a few headings, a few paragraphs, but nothing very complicated. And then hundreds of beautiful, I would say breathtaking, style sheets. And I'm just going to pluck out a 2 or 3 here just to show you. So it's just extraordinary to see the stuff that they've produced there. So here's that page, which is that simple HTML, but presented as a film poster. Here's that same page, no change in the HTML, only the style sheets change, presented as a poster package. Here is that same page presented as a comic, where all the text has been put into the text box. So CSS allows you to take good markup and do all sorts of things with it. And you don't have to change your content. You only have to change one file, which says how the page should be presented. Now, I will admit that there are some criticisms that were made about the techniques that are necessary for CSS and Angular, and I'm not going to go into them here, but this isn't yet the final solution for separating presentation and content. However, I will just say that there's a new specification emerging within W3C called XBL, which is the XML binding language, which is going to allow you much more freedom in how you do presentation. And this example, the text, the file that we're looking at here is very simple, textual output, San Francisco 130, New York 430. And using XBL, it turns SVG, structured vector graphics, into a style sheet language. And so now, at the top there, that's a screen dump of this page here, using SVG to make it beautiful. So there's still a long way to go. There are still a lot of possibilities. So let me talk about content a little bit. So HTML is actually extremely bad for document structure. If you're blind in particular, it's very difficult to read web pages because it's very difficult to work out the structure of the web pages. The only sorts of clues you've got are the level of headings, whether it's an H1 or H2, but lots of websites don't care about that anyway and don't use the H1s and H2s and H3s consistently, so that you still can't work out the structure. And you've got the horrible divs and spans, which don't give you much information for trying to work out the structure. You know that it's been structured in some way. It's very difficult to work out what that structure is meant to be. So one of the things that XHTML2 does is it explicitly allows a better structuring of data. So now rather than having H1 or H2 or H3, you just have a heading within a section, and sections can be nested. Now, there are a number of reasons why that's good. Cut and paste is an obvious one, that if you cut some code from one page and paste it in another one, then your headings remain consistently nested. But I would say, similarly, in PHP-like situations, when you're including bits of code from different places, it means that your markup is consistent because the bit that you're importing doesn't have to know about the context that it's in. It's just being loaded into the page. And a small advantage, you're no longer restricted to 6 levels of header. There's a very nice feature or discussion when has gone on about the HR element, because having decided that we were going to split content and presentation, then the obvious thing that we had to do was pull out all presentation elements out of the language and leave that in the CSS. CSS is better at presentation anyway. But the question remained, is HR presentation or not? Should we pull it out or shouldn't we? And on the other hand, the Japanese community was saying, oh, well, if you've got a horizontal rule, we need a vertical rule as well for vertical text. And so we've had lots of arguments about whether to keep HR around or not. And then we had an aha moment, and let me demonstrate that. Luckily, I've got 3 editions of Ulysses at home. So this is just an example of one page. And you'll see that thing in the middle, and I think you'd agree that if you're going to translate this page into HTML, then you translate that thing into an HR. Go away. You translate that thing into an HR. But now let's look at another edition of Ulysses. And you'll see that exact same text now doesn't have a horizontal rule there, but it has a star. And if we go to another edition, there we see 3 others. And that's what produced the aha moment, was that these are indeed all HRs. But what it means is that, firstly, HR is not a rule. And actually, it's not necessarily horizontal either. All you're doing is separating 2 bits of content. It's like a lightweight structural element. So having made that realization, we said, well, let's not call it HR anymore because it just creates so much confusion. People think it's horizontal, people think it's a rule. It's not, it's just a separator. We'll call it a separator. Paragraphs, obviously, you think of what a paragraph is as something, a semantic whole, and paragraphs in HTML are actually just a chunk of text with very little markup. So XHTML2 now allows you to do paragraphs properly. But This is just to give you a flavour of the sort of stuff that we had to go through. There's much, much more. Today's about a high-level view, so I don't want to stick around too much on the structure and stuff. But let's have a look at essence. So we've split content and presentation, but actually content isn't necessarily a unit thing. For instance, if you get a contract, you're an author and you're going to write a book, you get a contract from the publisher, and there's loads of content there which you as author had better read really carefully because you want to make sure that they're not going to rip you off. On the other hand, from the point of view of the publisher, all that stuff, that's just blah, 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 what they agreed years ago amongst themselves that they would offer authors. And for them, they just say, this is the standard author's contract, applies to the values of John Smith, and he's going to get 10%. So I would say that you don't only have content, but you also have essence. And that depends on your own context, whether it's content or whether it's essence. But certainly, for we as information providers, we want to provide a template where we leave holes and where we fill our essence into those holes. Now, the problem is that HTML supports providing essence extremely poorly and hardly at all. And that's why we have solutions like ASP and JSP, PHP, all these things have arisen in order to be able to add stuff into templates, basically. And it's also one of the reasons why page counts, when people want to show page counts, that they have to do it as an image, which is, of course, a really stupid idea, that you want to tell somebody how many times this page has been shown, and you can't just give them a number, you have to give them an image of the number. So XHTML2 grabs this problem and solves it in a really nice way. It's actually part of a greater solution known as XForms, which I'll be talking about more in a little while. But XForms allows you to import data from elsewhere into your document and then expose parts of that data in your content. So here's a very simple example. Instance is the element for importing data. I've given it a name, author, and then source. You can either put the data in line, but the interesting thing is where you get it from somewhere else. This URL where some XML document, so basically XML representation of your data, gets imported into your document. And then within the text of your HTML, then you can say output instance author name, and then that gets filled in at that point. So all of a sudden, without having to do scripting, without having to have third-party infrastructures, you can now start exposing essence within documents without having to do something special to serve. Meaning, so HTML has all these elements for creating structure, and they also suggest certain things about the structure, like a P suggests that this thing is a paragraph. It also has completely meaningless elements, I mean, very little semantics in, such as div. And then it has these few non-structured elements like address and title, which are adding semantics to a document. But again, they're very weak. I mean, address is essentially a useless element in HTML because it doesn't add any serious information except that somewhere in here there's some sort of address, but you don't know if it's an email address or a postal address. You just know it's an address. Completely useless. The HTML working group gets huge numbers of requests to add new elements. Of course, HTML is an extremely popular format, so we get an enormous amount of email asking us for new facilities. And new elements are the hardest to deal with. People want bibliographic markups, they want to be able to say that this thing contained in this is a person, represents a person, this is a note, this thing is a length, this thing is a number. I think the most off-the-wall request that we've got for an element was an element for representing irony. Our problem as a working group is, okay, they're good ideas, but, you know, how do you draw the line? How do you know in this huge long list of new elements where to say, okay, we'll include those elements, but we won't include those? Because otherwise, you don't want HTML to be thousands of elements representing all sorts of different semantics. So what we set out to do was try and find a solution that allowed you to add semantics that didn't mean that you had to keep adding elements into the language. So try and keep the language small, but try and have some mechanism for adding semantics. And so we have managed to do that. We found what I think is actually a rather nice mechanism for adding machine-readable information. And that, I mean, I think that's the important thing, is that that browsers or servers can do something with the knowledge of your markup. But rather than hardwiring it, wiring this information to the language, we've sort of added it as a layer. In the same way that you could say, in the same way that the presentation has been layered onto the language, it's a separate layer without being hardwired as the language. So as a result, we now say that XHTML2 essentially consists of structuring elements, and all the semantics is done by layering. Now, there are a number of different, and I should say that the use of this mechanism is still being worked on now. There are lots of people discovering new things that they can do with it. So I can show you the sort of stuff you could do, but I can assure you that in a year's time, people will have discovered new ways of doing great things with this. So a basic thing is that you could say that the role of this element is to represent something. So we don't have to have an element now for notes. We can just say the role of an element is a note. So for instance, a paragraph might be a note, but it might be just a single word telling you how to pronounce something. Or it might be a table, which is a sidebar, or something like that. So a note is now a semantic property of any element. Similarly, a navigation bar, you can now say that a div or a paragraph or a section, the role of that's the part is for navigation. So that's where your navigation area is. Now for accessibility, for instance, this is absolutely great because that means that accessibility software can now say, okay, we know that that's for navigation, then we won't deal with that for the time being. We won't read it to the person looking at this book, listening to this page, but we'll just keep it so that when they ask to navigate, then we can expose it. But these values are extensible, so you can add values to say that this section is about news, or this section is about weather, and so on and so on. So authors are now allowed to choose values for representing semantics, and so it being extensible, we don't have to deal with people's requests for new elements anymore. We can just say, fine, you can do this. This is how you do it. Another part of the semantics is that you can now add extra content information to the markup that's not exposed on the page, but that it's sitting there in the markup. And I'll give you some examples in a minute about how that can be used in useful ways. So, for instance, if you've got the text, it was reported yesterday that the Prime Minister flew to Washington, you can add information that tells you what yesterday means and who the Prime Minister is. So the person writing the article would say all this about the Prime Minister and want the text not to include the person's name. But somebody who's turning this into HTML or the metadata expert in the company or whatever can add metadata over the top for various usages. But, and this is one of the new things that's emerging, you can also classify data in particular ways. And this is an actual example that actually works. I won't take you through all of it, but this essentially says this paragraph contains details about an event, a calendar event. And so it says on, and then it says the date and time that it starts. It gives you the duration, but that doesn't actually show up. It therefore tells you the end. It tells you who's involved, and that they're doing something. In this case, it's a talk, and it's got the summary of the title, and it also gives you the location. Now, there are people already producing bookmarklets for this, so that you can click on it, and this takes your markup and exposes buttons that then you can click to add this event to your agenda automatically. But what you could also do is you could have a button that finds that location on a map, or that books a hotel for this event, or that goes to the web page for this event, or that looks up flights for this event. Now that the information there is machine readable, it's possible for the browser to give a much better user experience. In a way, if you know what microformats are, this is microformats done right, because it allows search engines to do better stuff. It now knows that page that says the Prime Minister, that the Prime Minister is Tony Blair, so that when you search for Tony Blair, you'll find this page as well. And the other things that I've said about adding things to your address book, or finding things on a map, or adding things to your agenda, finding it on a map, location, hotels, flights, and so on and so on. But what it also means is that now that the data, your content is machine readable, that upstream processes can do interesting stuff with this as well. For instance, transforming content, and we've had this discussion already today, to different devices, that you can now encode your content so that the transforming processor knows much more about the content and how to send it to the device. And that takes us on to the question of diversity. Now, I can only assume that not many people know this, but when you click on a link, people think the URL gets sent to the server and the server sends a document back. But actually, it's much more than that. There are many more possibilities, because something called content negotiation happens as well. When you send your URL, it sends lots of information about the browser and what it's willing to accept. So, for instance, when I click on a link, it says that I speak English, French, and Dutch, and I'm willing to accept them in the order English, Dutch, and French. Actually, it also says that I prefer British English to American English, but that's not really important. But this information actually gets sent with the request for a document. And so if the server has different versions of a document in different languages, then it can say, oh, this person prefers English, right, here's the English version. And this is why it drives me crazy, that when I come to Germany and I go to google.com, I get re-diverted to google.de in German. And I think, I told the damn server that I don't speak German. Why is it giving me German with a link saying it is the English version? Why didn't it just give me the English version in the same place? In the first place. And the same with, and I'm picking on German sites here because these are the ones that I've most recently been looking at. The German railway is exactly the same, that if I go to bahn.de, I get a German page with a link on it saying, here's the English version. And I think, well, I've told them that I want English. Why didn't they give me that in the first place? So diversity here, I'm talking about different people's needs, and the fact that you can actually supply those needs without having to ask them what you want, because they've already said it. And I should say that content negotiations are not as good as it ought to be. There are lots of things that ought to be said as well. For instance, how fast is your connection? That would be great. And you wouldn't, if you went to Walt Disney's site, it wouldn't ask you, do you want this film clip in small size or medium size or big size? It would know which one would be best to send to you. And for instance, if I've got a tiny screen, I'd like that information to be sent with the request as well. So content negotiation isn't the be-all and end-all, but at least it tells the server some things about the person who's coming that at the moment is largely being ignored. Sometimes, just for fun, I put my languages in the wrong order just to see if there are any sites at all looking at these damn values. And there's a pleasant surprise every now and then I get a French site that have also got an English version, but not many people are paying attention to my needs on this score. Now, we had a great talk this morning about diversity of devices. The world isn't just PCs, and in fact, there are more browsers on phones now than on PCs. Way more. It's not order of magnitude yet, but it's certainly more than double. And the problem is these phones are not being used because, as was pointed out this morning, you go to a website in most places, most websites just won't work on your phone. And so it's really great to go to Japan And this is on a Japanese railway station. There are actually five women there, and they're all browsing the web on their phone. And that's because in Japan, websites really do pay attention to phones, and you really can get some good content to your telephone. And let's face it, this is an area of growth. If there aren't that many browsers available, not being used, then there's no better way that I can think of increasing the number of hits to your site than to think about diversity. But we're not only talking about phones, actually. I know a company producing a browser on a refrigerator, but there are PDAs, there are printers, there are an incredible number of screen sizes and resolutions and form factors that really the diversity of devices is just fantastic. And we don't only have diversity of devices, but we also have diversity of people in another way. And I would say that all of us are visually impaired sometime or another. For instance, somebody at a conference gives a demonstration of their application, and they show it up on the screen, and of course it's really tiny, you can't really see it, so you have to believe what they're doing. I've seen it happen at least once today, no names, no background. But often there's too much information on the screen, and so they reduce the screen size, the character size to get it on, but then you can't read it. Or when we display our glasses. But there's also another reason why we want accessible websites. It's because all of us here will one day be 80 years old, hopefully. And when we're 80, we will want to continue to use the web, because that's where all the information will be. And so don't think of it as doing good for people. Think of it as designing for your future self. Think of it as websites have got to be accessible because we want to use the web in 50 years' time, 20 years' time, however old you are. And so we better get the message across that websites have got to be accessible. I would say that the fact that we have these so-called 10-foot interfaces for certain applications is an admission of defeat or an admission of failure, because you shouldn't have to have 10-foot interfaces, because there are some people who need text that large when they're 1 foot from the screen. And so you shouldn't have one application for when you're 10 feet away, one application for when you're nearby. You need one application that can deal with all sorts of requirements, visual requirements for different people. So diversity support is a major part of XHTML, because you don't want to have to write your website 10 times for 10 different devices. You want to design your website as few times as possible, of course, because after a time, the amount of money that's necessary to produce the next version of the website is just going to be too much. So it's important that our tools support diversity, so that we can get our information in once and hopefully have to do fairly small amounts of work, for instance, a different style sheet, in order to make our website accessible on different devices and for different people. So XHTML2 supports content negotiation much better than HTML, for instance, and it allows you to mark up media-specific parts of your document so that you can say, well, this bit of the information is only visible on large screens. And finally, function. XHTML2 adds XForms. XForms has been designed as a replacement for HTML forms by doing an analysis of the websites that we've now got, the use of forms on the web, and saying, well, what are the requirements? What do we really need? And trying to do that. As a result, XForms has turned out to be much more general than just for filling in forms. In fact, since it's got input for typing in values, and it's got output, you've seen that already, for producing stuff on the screen, and it's got a data model and a computational model, in fact, it's pretty good for general purpose functionality. Now, yeah, so what? So is JavaScript. Okay, well, let me deal with that in a bit more detail. We've already seen how easy it is to import data into your document from any other source. But it also allows you allows you to replace that data dynamically in a declarative way, without programming, without script. So that, in fact, a lot of uses of JavaScript for that sort of facility for getting data into your page without having to refresh the page, those uses of JavaScript are now gone. You can just do it declaratively and say, here's where my data is coming from, here's when it's going to get changed. Xform also allows you to expose and hide parts of the user interface without having to refresh the page or resorting to JavaScript. Let me just show you a quick example. Xform has been embraced by a number of industries, most fully by the British insurance industry. They've all stepped over to Xform. So this is now Firefox running Xform. This is actually a section of a real life insurance form produced by Origo, which is the standards body for the insurance industry in Great Britain. So this is a real form. It's got a button here for terms and conditions. It says here, I hereby pretend to agree to all sorts of terms and conditions that I haven't read. I don't really know, but you have to click on agree. And having done that, then the rest of the form pops up. I'll just take that away so you can see that those are popping up. Now, there's no script here. This is all done decoratively. The business rule, as it were, is that you're not going to show the form until somebody has actually said that they agreed. So the moment they stop agreeing, all the rest of the form disappears. So now I can go to different parts of the form. This is interesting that the browser knows that this form value is a date, and so it allows you to pop up a date picker. But there's no code in there for date pickers. It just says input a date here. But the fact that the browser knows that it's a date, it supplies a date picker automatically.
All of this is happening client-side?
This is all happening client-side, yeah. This is just one page you're looking at that's exposing and hiding different parts of the interface declaratively. As you click on a button, that exposes a different part of the interface. This form is actually for money laundering. And so in this case, you want evidence of the person's name, when you can say, well, he showed his currently fully signed passport, and then all of a sudden part of the interface gets exposed, only for filling in that details. But if you say, no, it wasn't that, it was a residence permit, then you have to fill in details for that. So all these values, all these possibilities are in the form, but they're only exposed as necessary. And the nice thing is, it's all being done without scripting. It's just being done by declaratively saying that this piece of interface is only of importance under certain conditions. So I don't think there's particularly anything more here that I need to show you here, except that Xforms is being used widely, and in this case, very enthusiastically by the insurance industry in Britain. So you saw there exposing and hiding parts of the user interface without refreshing the page or resorting to JavaScript. But another interesting thing is that the form controls are actually very abstract. And the form controls only say what you're trying to achieve and not how you're going to achieve it. So in HTML, you have to say radio buttons or drop-down menu or whatever. In Xforms, you just say, this control is selecting one thing from a list of things. The nice thing about that is that you then just use star sheets for different devices. So if you haven't got much screen space, then you use a menu for selecting the thing. But if you've got lots of screen space, then you can use radio buttons. So without having to change the markup, you just change the style sheet for a different sort of device, and you get a different interface that uses the screen state more usefully. And actually, the nicest demonstration of the success of this was by Oracle. Oracle did an extremely good implementation of Xforms. And we had a workshop of implementations before Xforms became final. And they came along and did a demonstration. And they basically showed the same form, the traditional order a pizza form. At first, they showed it on a PC, clicking the ingredients you wanted on your pizza. And then they showed the same form on the screen of cell phone, great. But then they used a voice browser. They phoned out a telephone number, and you get a voice at the other end reading this form to you. What do you want on your pizza? Exactly the same form, just a different front end for the form. And actually, very, very cute. because sometimes you get the hourglass when the machine's busy. Well, the hourglass for when the machine was busy on the voice browser was the sound of somebody typing. So he said, "What would you like?" And he said, "Cheese." And they go, very good, very good. But that wasn't all. Having done that, then he showed an instant messenger button. And he clicked on his instant messenger button, and up came the pizza order service. And it said, "Hi, what do you want on your pizza?" And you could order the pizza exactly the same form, only a different front end. So that was a great demonstration of the value of these abstractions, the intent-oriented form controls, because you didn't have to rewrite the application for the different devices. You just had to do a different front end to it, and all the rest of the system was working exactly the same way. Now, applications over the web are, of course, one of the things that is big now. We call it Web 2. The person who first used the word Web 2 in public was Tim O'Reilly from the O'Reilly Publishers. I talked to him recently. He said it has nothing to do with applications over the web. People haven't understood that. Okay, but never mind. This is now what we call Web 2. One of the big advantages, of course, is that everybody's got the most recent version of the application. You don't have to worry about legacy anymore. But part of the problem is that they're really difficult and expensive to produce. I mean, Google Maps, of course, which is like the poster child of applications of the web, is more than 200K of JavaScript. And if you've ever written a JavaScript program of 200 lines, you'll know that 200K lines is going to be pretty bad. And in fact, I know one company who's been doing AJAX applications since 1999, and they say that over a certain size, you start losing programmers to nervous breakdowns. So, I mean, it really is important, because JavaScript doesn't have the engineering support a lot of programming languages have. According to the Department of Defense, which produces an enormous number of applications, 90% of the cost of producing an application is debugging. It's easy to write a program, but after that, you've got to get it right. But another interesting factoid, according to Fred Brooks, who was a manager of IBM for many years of very large products and projects, he says that the number of bugs in a program are not linear to its size, but quadratic. That is to say, the length of the program to the power of 1.5. So that means that if a program is 10 times longer, it doesn't have 10 times as many bugs. No, it has about 32 times more bugs. So in other words, a large program is much more expensive, relatively, to produce than a small program. Which is another way, a program that's 10 times smaller needs only 3% of the effort or the cost. And there's another problem as well. Part of the wonder of the web is that everybody was able to produce web pages. But, you know, applications are really hard to write. Your grandmother might be able to produce a web page, but she's sure as hell not going to write a program. There's an interesting exception, though, is that spreadsheets, a lot of non-programmers do actually write spreadsheets. And I would claim that the reason behind that is that it's a different programming model. It's declarative. You say that this thing is related to that thing, but you don't say anything more than that. You don't say how to change it or under what conditions. The program works that out for yourself. And that's an advantage of declarative programming, that you don't have to do all that administrative, boring, fiddly detailed stuff. You just say, you just say what the relationship between things are, what you want to happen, but not how you want it to happen. Now, there's some interesting work being done in this area, and one of the most interesting work is being done by a London company called Export.net, who are producing a sidewind rich web browser. They're only using standards, so they're not having to invent anything new. They're taking XHTML, they're taking XForms, they're taking SVG and XBL, which I talked to you about earlier, and turning that into an environment for producing applications. So, for instance, these clocks, to produce a clock, you just say output value equals whatever the value of the time is, and then the appearance is an analog clock, and then the XBL just uses that for getting the right style sheet for an analog clock. But having done this nice, simple example, but I mean, nothing earth-shaking, they said, let's do Google Maps. So they only did a pilot model just to see whether they could do it and how much work it would take. So this isn't quite finished, but it's the essence. It's essentially Google Maps. It can do most of the things that Google Maps could do. It can do a few extra things as well. It's all written in XForms and XHTML. There's hardly any scripting. There are here and there little bits of scripting. But the interesting thing about it is that compared with 200k plus of JavaScript in Google's maps, it's only 25 kilobytes of code. So it's about an order of magnitude smaller. And remember that empirically, a program that's an order of magnitude smaller needs only 3% of the effort to build. So you know, it's not only making it 10 times smaller, it's making it 30 times easier to build. Now, when we heard this, which we'd already had an inkling that decorative applications was the way to go, we started looking for more data points, and we have had a few since then. A British insurance company, they're using XForms, asked two groups to draw up plans to implement certain functionality. One was going to do it scripting, and one was going to do it using XForms. So group one, the scripting group, came back and said, well, it would take them about a month to work out how long it was going to take to do. Whereas the XForms group came back and said, we're done. The next day. So we were very pleased to hear that as well. And then the third one that we heard was a major company that I'm not allowed to tell you who they are because they don't want their competitors to know that they've got this advantage. This company makes huge pieces of machinery that has a very complicated interface. And they're constantly making new lines of these. I mean, they're churning out every year, churning out new five new lines of product. So they've always got people producing user interfaces. And so they know how long it takes to make a user interface for their devices. And normally, they put a group of 30 people on it, but it would take 5 years to produce the user interface. Now last year, they said, let's try XForms. Let's see if we can do it decoratively. What it costs us to do and how the resulting interface looks. And it took 10 people 1 year, including learning XForms, to do. So what I'm saying is here that I think this backs up the idea that decorative applications is the way to go, because all the work is being done by the computer and not by the human. And since most of our computers are idle most of the time anyway, that's not a big deal. But the advantages aren't only in reducing the costs of production. There are a number of other advantages that this approach gives you. Firstly, it gives you, at long last, a chance of accessible applications, because JavaScript applications are just not accessible for blind people. Because of this approach where you're layering a user interface over the top basic functionality, like that clock example, where you've got the text time, but then you're layering that beautiful analog clock, that text is still there. And so a blind person can still see or still work out that it's 12:30 without having to do anything special to try and work out what this image on the screen is. You can just layer an accessible interface on the top. You can layer that just as easily as a visual one. At long last, it gives you device-independent applications, because now the application is only the functionality. The user interface is now a layer over the top. And so if you want to have the same application with a different user interface on a telephone and a different interface on the PC, you don't have to rewrite your code. You just layer a star sheet user interfaces. It allows you to do reuse, because all your user interfaces are now in a separate star sheet, then you can just grab things. If you need an analog clock, then you just use the analog clock. You don't have to rewrite it. And as you see, much, much, much less coding, because you don't have to do all the administrative stuff. Okay, so I've come to the end. So, as a conclusion, we set out to define a web format that addressed as many existing problems with the web as we could, by taking and only taking requirements from different communities. So we didn't make any of this up ourselves. We were only interested in taking other people's requirements. Clearly, it needs a lot of work and consultation, because every time we make a change, we go back to the originating community and say, well, does this address your problem? Are you happy with this? But as a result, SHU1-2 is close to ready now. We should hopefully go to last call this year. Last call means where we as a working group say, okay, we're done, take a look at it, let us know what is not yet right. And hopefully that process will go fairly quickly. X-Forms was produced in parallel. It's actually already in widespread use now. It's already available. It will be integrated in XHTML2, but it's already usable now. But what we've also noticed from people who are interested in using XHTML2 is that even while it's not available in browsers, it's still useful in itself as a representation format for information, because it contains so much information about the information that it's much easier to use that form of the data for transforming it into different target devices. Okay, I'm done. Questions.
Thank you very much. I have a question to your X-Forms example. X-Forms, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd argue that there are some accessibility issues with it.
Accessibility issues?
And how would you say X-Forms does deal with accessibility? And you mentioned this MVC pattern. Is there like an MVC access to this X-Form model?
In fact, there's a blind person. Well, in fact, one of the technically extremely clever guy, TV Raman, and he's on the X-Forms working group. And so, it wasn't allowed out of the door until it was accessible. So X-Forms is accessible out of the box because all the information is there. Even if you present it in a different way, the information is there, so a blind person can use it without having to do anything special. So that's one of our claims. X-Forms is accessible out of the box.
Hi. I just have to say that your presentation fills me with a mixture of joy and relief, which is a wonderful thing. But you talked a bit about the idea of being able to show, describe content and then switch certain parts of content on and off.
Yeah.
In a given situation. You went through that very quickly. Could you just describe that in a little more detail?
So it's actually related to the data. To give you an example, you've got a set of data about a person, and you've got a piece of data, spouse's name. Now what you can say is, you can add a business rule if you like, that says spouse's data is only relevant if another value, marital status, is married. And when data is not relevant, it gets a different CSS class, if you like. So you can decide in your star sheet how to display it. But typically what happens is if a value is not relevant, any control bound to it disappears. So it's made invisible. But you can gray it out if you want. These are options decisions you make yourself. But typically what happens is that you say this piece of interface is only interested in the spouse, and that automatically disappears then if there are no conditions that seems me asking to fill in the spouse's name. So you basically put baby business rules about the data.
Are you also suggesting some language or semantic way of describing this?
It's part of X-Forms.
Steve, thank you for the presentation. In your slide about semantics, I saw the attribute data, which you can store all kinds of things.
Yeah.
What I didn't really understand, who gives meaning to all those? Well, thanks, in fact.
I didn't want to get too technical about that section. But in fact, there's a very simple relationship between that data and RDF. If you know what RDF is, then I've probably said enough. But the relationship between the markup and the RDF that you get out is described in about a paragraph. And so the So you've extracted as RDF, and then you've just got all everything that to do with RDF and the semantic web is already at your disposal, and then you can use all that stuff. You can put it in an RDF store. You can use it as you would any RDF.
Three more questions, and they've already got their hands up. You were the first. Didn't you have one? Two more questions. Three more questions, then we're going to get you then.
Yeah. You said that it's possible in HTML to pull out information from XML. So does that mean XSLT gets deprecated, or what's going to happen?
Well, XSLT, the transformation language, has another purpose, and maybe upstream that is being used somewhere. It does cover some of the use cases of XSLT, it's true. But the advantage in this case is that it's all happening in the browser client side, and Delta, as it were. You know, it's not the whole document being re-transformed, but it's just the little bits that you're dealing with. So they've got separate use cases, separate requirements. So it doesn't deprecate XSLT.
Just a detailed question. No, in JavaScript we have all the nice things to guide or use direction, slide in, slide out, fade and dim, and all these transitions.
Yeah.
We like to keep them, and when we switch to XHTML2, are they included? Are you maintaining this?
So you have to realize that sort of thing we regard as presentation. But the answer is yes, it is being kept, but not in XHTML2. Those are the people at export.net are just showing how you do that using star sheets, and so it just dims. So that sort of effect is possible. But you don't want to encode that in your content. You want to encode that in your star sheet or user interface.
One last question.
You showed us the example of your event presentation for this URIA, and then you said,
yeah.
Well, this is a micro format done right.
Yes.
There are many initiatives now to define all kinds of micro formats, so how does that relate to...
So micro formats have a similar aim to encode machine-readable information into your document, into your HTML document. But the restriction that they give themselves is no new XHTML markup, which is laudable. But it means that to do certain things, they've had to cheat a little bit, or they've had to squeeze things into places that didn't really belong there. It means that they can actually only talk about the whole document. They can't talk about other resources, because there's no way of saying, I'm talking about that thing over there, I'm going to really talk about the thing that you're reading at that moment. And nesting microformats, they're not scalable in a sense. You could have a microformat, but if you try to nest two microformats together, then all of a sudden things start getting messy, and for each combination of microformat, you have to say what the rules are. And so basically, you have to go to Tantec Jellick and say, we want to add this, and he says yes or no. Whereas what we've said is, first, we have freedom to add stuff, so we can now say what we're talking about. We can now have the content attributes, so that you can put content there instead of putting it in the title attribute where it's not really, where it shouldn't really be. And we can define in a general way how things nest. So, go forth and create microformats. They will automatically work together, and no one party has to take control and say whether something can be a microformat or not.
Stephen, thank you very, very much.